Hi there, everyone. This is Lori Edge Hughes, and thank you for joining me on another presentation. And this one is on physical therapy applications for pain management in sports medicine. And my thought, my hope, and my goal with this is you will have some very practical takeaways in how to utilize your rehab knowledge towards pain relief in specific, so in the case of the sporting dog patient. So essentially what we know, musculoskeletal injuries can impede an athlete from competing in their sport, and chronic musculoskeletal conditions such as arthritis can impact performance, quality of life, and the ability to continue engaging in sporting activities. And obviously this is not something that we want, not something that the owners want, not likely something that the dog wants. And most of the owners that are competing in sports with their dogs, that is their social life. So, you know, for their dog to be injured, or in the case of osteoarthritis, which we're going to look at today because that's hugely prevalent, you know, it takes away that social aspect of their life. And for the dogs, that is just so important for them to be doing activities. Most of them just absolutely love and thrive on it. So we're going to look at that specifically. So when we look at osteoarthritis, there are different pain mechanisms or types of pain. So you would have mechanical pain, and this can be due to abnormal loading of the joint itself. The joint is not quite what it used to be. So there's abnormal loading in through there. Sometimes that's the actual joint surfaces, but I think we also have to pay attention that that can be abnormal muscle usage around. So that can cause mechanical pain. And there can be stress on the capsules, the ligaments, as well as the periarticular tissue. Now there might also be inflammatory pain, so the release of chemicals secondary to the osteoarthritis flare-ups. When there is inflammation in a joint, there becomes increased responses within the A-beta, A-delta, and the type C afferent fibers. And they start responding to both noxious as well as innocuous joint movements. So stuff that shouldn't normally hurt starts signaling, going, oh my God, that was sore. I would say it's kind of like dealing with, you know, a 13-year-old girl. For the physiotherapist, you recognize this. The 13-year-old girl is like, oh my God, that hurts. Oh my God, that hurts. Oh yeah, that hurts too. And it's like, oh, for crying out loud, shut up and be objective. So basically, the joints have lost their objectivity. They're now 13-year-old girls, drama queens, just, oh my God, that hurts. In addition to that, we also have activation of the silent nociceptors. So these are nociceptors that are normally quiet. They just sit there, they don't do anything, but now when pain comes on board, they start to respond and send signals to, again, both noxious and innocuous stimuli. So it can be just movement or pressure can all of a sudden, stuff that would not really be painful and should not be something that the body is signaling. It's not a danger, it's not tissue damage. So the body starts signaling all of this stuff up to the spinal cord and the brain. But when you get an area, a tissue, a joint that is signaling like crazy, you get what's called peripheral sensitization. So that just basically means that the tissues, all the receptors in that area are sensitized. They're 13-year-old girl drama queens. Everything is getting signaled as, oh my God, that's pain. Once you have peripheral sensitization, this can lead to central sensitization of the dorsal horn neurons at the spinal cord. So because all of these pain signals are sending, and you've got drama queen down on one end, now the spinal cord starts to go into, oh my gosh, maybe I should actually pay attention to this. And it starts listening to all those pain messages that are coming up to the spinal cord. So it starts to get sensitized. It starts to interpret, and react and actually start listening to the drama queen and all the messages that the drama queen is sending up the chain. In addition to that, you also get a loss of inhibitory pain control mechanisms. So no longer is the spinal cord saying, it's okay. Oh, that's just the 13-year-old girl down there talking. That's just the drama queen. Now it's like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, she's actually right. I need to pay attention. So it stopped sending that it's okay, it's okay, you we don't have to listen to that. Don't send that message to the brain. Brain's too busy doing other stuff, really. Don't listen to that. It stops the inhibitory pain control mechanisms. And so you start to, or now we're talking about dogs, same happens to you. But basically what happens is then you now start to interpret and respond and perceive the pain. Okay, so the message goes up to the brain. The brain is responsible for whether we actually perceive pain or not. And so you get the perception of pain, you get pain, and with that you're going to get loss of function. And so physical therapy is and rehab, I suppose, here, all the same thing, is very much in touch with loss of function. So not just the pain, but then taking it that next step to looking at the loss of function. So clinically, what we see and hear with osteoarthritis is there's aching, discomfort, and pain that increases with excessive activity. Okay? Not all activity, excessive activity usually. There tends to then be a reduction in overall activity levels. There becomes a reduced ability to perform activities. You can also get poorer proprioception. And let me talk on that for just a second, because this isn't proprioception as in your neurologic dog and you start, you know, crossing over and you lose your placing reflex. Not at all. This is your joint's awareness of where it is in space. So for an example, one way that they measure this in osteoarthritic knees is they would have the human patient lying on their stomach and the therapist would bend one knee up into a certain position and ask the patient, can you match this leg position with your other leg? And so let's say they've bent it and it's at, for ease, 90 degrees. And so they ask the patient to bend their other leg and match that position. And often what they're finding is with a loss of proprioception, joint damage, joint irritation, throw in their, you know, when we get talking ever about ACL problems, meniscal derangement, you know, this proprioception is lost in that case too. But they find that the patient can't match the position. They overshoot, they don't get it close enough, they don't have that sensibility from one side to the other. So there's fun party tricks you can try at your next family function. Make everybody lie down and see who has the worst knee proprioception. But that's what I mean by proprioception in this scenario. There's also joint stiffness, enlargement, and effusion of the joint. It then progresses and you get loss of flexibility, and you're also going to get loss of strength. So all of these things are things we need to look at, think about, and manage and address as rehab professionals. So, we need to have a caveat that certainly animals that have severe, clinically severe osteoarthritis should likely retire from sports, or at least sport of the same capacity. I think it's lovely that there have been sports that have been introduced, like rally obedience, where it's not as intense as obedience, and it's not as high drive, high speed as agility, and it's an in-between activity. So there are some modifications, and certainly there's always stuff that people can do with their dog. But if the osteoarthritis is really, really bad, then likely they would do better to be retired from sport completely. But looking at that with a grain of salt, too. But what about the multitude of athletic dogs and horses, for that case, too, with mild to moderate osteoarthritis? And there'd be a plethora of them. And in which case, physical therapy, rehab, pain management can help these athletes tremendously. So let's go in and we'll look at heat. Okay? So we'll look at heat. Okay, and so this is, I laughed. I got an email from someone. I posted something about a bunch of Dachshunds. It was a cartoon of Dachshunds that up against a bar, and it was called the Wiener Dog Bar. And I got a Facebook post back saying, I don't get it. And it was a friend from Austria, and she's like, I don't get it. What does that mean? So for all of my international listeners, so the joke with this is a hot dog, right? A hot dog is a North American thing. You'd put a sausage in a bun, and the sausage in the bun is often called a wiener over here, unless you're in Australia, in which case a wiener is a small penis, and you shouldn't put that in a bun, but I'm not going there. So anyways, that is the explanation for my international people with wieners and hot dogs and all the rest. We're good to go. Things you didn't think you'd learn about on your PT pain management and sports webinar thing here. Okay, so we'll go to heat. So heat can be useful for symptomatic relief of arthritis pain and stiffness. Okay, it can have short-term reductions in pain in acute and subacute low back pain. So if we look at the proposed sequence of physiologic cellular functions as to why heat would be good for pain relief. So I'm going to break this down. So the next slide here. So first off, heat can cause a vasodilation. The vasodilation can help increase cell metabolism, can help increase blood flow. So in one hand, this might help promote soft tissue healing. And the other hand, it might flush away the chemical irritants that are surrounding the nociceptors. So your inflammatory pain, it might help to flush away all the things that are pain signals. Next, your heating can cause activation of thermoreceptors, which could act as a counter irritant. So remember the pain gating mechanism. So in brief, that if the spinal cord starts paying attention to the heat signals, it starts to not pay attention to the pain signals. So maybe we get a counter irritation effect. And it might also help then with sedation and relaxation. And this can decrease pain and help promote relaxation. And then lastly, your heating can create a decrease in tissue viscosity by warming of the external tissues and the interarticular tissues, and this can help reduce joint stiffness. So these would be then the ways then why you would justify, how you would justify heat as part of a plan. So how you might look at this, or how, my advice to looking at where heat could be incorporated. So this could be utilized as part of the day-to-day management for arthritic joints. So this would be something that the owners can utilize, and then as a rehab practitioner, that I would advise the clients then to look at maybe heating prior to engaging in physical activities. Warm up the tissues, maybe we flush out the irritants, help with stiffness. All of this can help with function as well as pain relief prior to engaging in a physical activity. So what about cold? So cryotherapy. So cryotherapy is well supported by research for acute pain and injury in that it aids, ice aids with swelling reduction and improved range of motion in osteoarthritis. So cases where the arthritic joint is thick and swollen. And so again, if we look at the physiologic effects of cryotherapy and how this falls in, so we're going to break this one down as well. So your cooling. Cooling effects can cause a vasoconstriction, which can decrease cell metabolism and blood flow, decreased secondary cell hypoxia injury, and then we can get a cold-induced vasodilation or a rebound effect, rebound vasodilation, where you then have a whoosh, an increase in your blood flow, which is still below the baseline level. So it's not like you're adding heat. You're just basically cooling everything down, and then whoosh, you let it flush again a little bit. You would still have adequate blood flow to the cooled tissues, and there would not be cold-induced tissue damage. So you're just cooling it down to below baseline values. And then your cooling can also increase cold receptor activity. And in doing so, you will have a decrease in nerve conduction velocity of the primary afferent fibers. This can act as a counter irritant and help with the pain gating. So maybe just to shut down those nerves one, to shut off the activity, the signaling of the nerves, and two, for the pain-getting mechanism. So, again, this is why this could be extremely useful for your acute pain, okay? With this, you have decreased pain, increased pain tolerance, and, again, you'll get your cold-induced vasodilation, the rebound effect, and, again, all the same things I listed, increased blood flow but still below baseline levels, adequate blood flow to the cooled tissues, and you won't have, and you would hopefully prevention of cold-induced tissue damage, or rather your vasodilation helps to prevent the cold-induced tissue damage. And then lastly, cooling can decrease gamma motor neuron activity, can decrease muscle spindle activity, all of which will decrease spasm and spasticity of the adjacent muscles, okay, or the target muscles. And again, all that then ties that back down into you get your rebound vasodilation as well. So how you might look at utilizing cryotherapy or your cold therapy is ice may be utilized post-activity to aid in pain relief. Okay? It can be used to control acute inflammation, such as in the case of injuries, and it can also be used for osteoarthritis flare-ups. So anytime there is a flare or you've walked that fine line and maybe you stepped over it and you overdid it on your exercising or your dog, you overdid it exercising your dog. So ice can be useful then to help with the flare-ups. Okay, and next we move on to therapeutic laser. So with our therapeutic laser, we know this can aid with tissue repair, so that's great. It can relieve pain directly and can also be used to stimulate acupuncture points. And so we're going to have lots of utilization or potential utilization for laser with this. So the general effectiveness of the laser can be due to anti-inflammatory mechanisms, which are similar to pharmacologic agents. So it's shown to be similar to celecoxib, meloxicam, diclofenac, and dexamethasone. Laser has the ability to reduce oxidative stress of the tissues, can help improve angiogenesis, can help augmentation of collagen synthesis and skeletal repair. So fabulous then for our arthritic joints, our crappy cartilage in our joints. And also it's been shown to inhibit transmission at the neuromuscular junction. So we get reduced nerve firing as well. So this is fabulous and gives us lots of opportunity to thought process about not just lasering the target tissue, but lasering nerves that supply that area as well. So we'll get into that more. So some fabulous high-quality reviews and meta-analysis. So this one by Chow et al. So Chow et al. And Bjordahl. Chow and Bjordahl, I would have to say, are my favorite laser researchers because they've done these great meta-analysis, really digging through the research and spitting it back out and saying, these are the studies that show it works, and here's why. Here's the dosages that they used in the studies that it worked on. So this one looked at acute and chronic neck pain and found that the optimum dose per point with an 820 or 830 nanometer laser was 5.9 joules. Okay, so that particular study, they basically lasered along the neck, you know, your trapezius where you got all those knots up by your shoulder and your traps, and they basically lasered as many of them as the patient had pain. And so in your 800 nanometer range, it was 5.9. Then they also looked at the papers that utilized a 904 superpulsed laser. So these lasers are a little bit different. These lasers are unlike your regular class 3B lasers, where it's generally a continuous wave or a chopped up wave. These ones, the laser light is mostly off until it goes pow and you get a burst of laser light. And so that might be like a 30 or 60 watt blast of laser for a fraction of a second, and then it's off again. And what they've seen with these ones is it creates what's called a photo bleaching, which essentially means that the superficial layers of the cells are bleached so that all subsequent flashes of light can penetrate deeper. And they've actually shown that it's it's very effective for pain relief. So, and I would say we have a couple super pulse lasers in the clinic, and we love it. We use it in combination with the 800 nanometers, but we love it for pain relief. Absolutely fabulous for neck pain and back pain. But anyway, I digress. So using these super pulse lasers, because the laser is mostly off and you're just doing these blasts, what they've found is that it's actually you utilize a lot less joules or total joules. So we would only have to use 2.2 joules using the super pulse laser. That being said, it takes a lot longer to deliver 2.2 joules with a super pulse, but that's your target with those. Within the studies, the number of repetitions and treatments per week were variable, and they found that the positive effects were immediate and could be maintained for up to 3 months after the treatment ended. So that's hugely encouraging. So another one here, this is Bjordal et al., 2006, and they found that low-level laser therapy at high doses, so this study used 7.5, or not used, they went through the literature, this is more of a review paper as well, that 7.5 joules per centimeter squared at the target tissue, so this means that you could likely use more superficially. If your target tissue is down in there a centimeter or two, you can use more at the surface. Anyways, was used in the first 72 hours to reduce inflammation. And then they lowered the dose back down to what you would find traditionally. So 2 joules per centimeter squared at the target tissue in the subsequent days for acute injuries in order to promote tissue healing. And I'll explain this one a little bit, because the thought process with this was that from some of the studies we've looked at with nerves, there was a different Chow et al. Study that looked at nerves that found that it reduces nerve conduction. And so that study was using high doses right over the dorsal root ganglions and found that it reduced nerve conduction. So with the thought process that a high dose can reduce nerve conduction, which will help for pain, if you have an acute injury, you have heat, you have swelling, you have increased blood flow, so that by putting in a high dose at the surface, most of that laser is being flushed away by the increase in blood flow and the increase in distance, because you've got all the swelling to go through, so that they predicted that the dose that was actually getting to the target tissue is likely that lower dose, that 2 joules, that's actually only getting to the target tissue to help for healing, but you're helping with the pain relief by high dosing it for the first 72 hours after an acute injury. So throw this into your thought processing. It makes sense for acute injuries. I have played around with it for osteoarthritic flare-ups as well. So throw that out there, that maybe you could do blast a high dose for a pain flare-up and then take it down to tissue healing dosages there afterwards. So it might be a way to use it. So here's another one then, and this one looked at what's out there in the literature and the dosages. So they found that laser reduces pain and improves health status in chronic joint disorders. So the knee doses that were found, and this is total per session, that were found in the literature varied from 2.1 to 12 joules total per session. Lumbar spine, 16 to 60 joules total. TMJ, 0.7 to 2.1 total, and for the cervical spine, 10 to 60 joules total. So, and again, most of this literature, if not all, has been utilized or conducted utilizing a class 3B lasers. Those are the only lasers, there's honestly, where you can know what you are delivering superficially, because your other lasers, where you're scanning, where it's such a high dose that you're scanning, you don't know what you're delivering to one particular area. So this is as it pertains to a class 3B. So my advice for therapeutic lasers: athletic animals with osteoarthritis may be well served by semi-regular or proactive laser sessions. Injuries or osteoarthritic flare-ups can also be managed with this modality. So we would have lots of use for laser. I have 6 lasers in my clinic. Love, love, love laser. Okay. Now we can get into our TENS. Okay, so our TENS stands for transcutaneous electrical neuromuscular stimulation. And the thought process for why TENS helps with pain relief is we can get segmental inhibition through pain gating mechanisms. So this is basically at the spinal cord level. The TENS input goes in, you feel a buzz and a tingle, you stimulate, I should have looked this up, I think it's the A-beta fibers register buzz and tingle and vibration. Those nerves are stimulated and it settles down the activity in the others, your A delta and your C fibers, and so reduces nociception. And then it will help with the descending inhibitory mechanisms, so that which I just spoke of. And we know then that the different frequencies of TENS produce analgesia through actions on different neurotransmitters and receptors. Okay, so we have high frequency and low frequency TENS. We're going to look at these. So your high frequency TENS or conventional TENS that's greater than 60 hertz, this is the buzzing sensation. If you've tried it on yourself, it's the one that buzzes, the one that I would tell human patients that it's going to feel like ants crawling around on your skin. So your high frequency TENS creates a selective stimulation of large diameter fibers in the peripheral nerves. And in doing so, it helps to block nociceptive activity in the smaller afferents at the segmental level. Okay? Oops, did I flip too fast? Nope, we're good. Okay. It will also help increase the concentration of beta endorphins in the bloodstream and the cerebral spinal fluid, so the happiness endorphins, we'll just go with that then. Looking for a word for endorphins and my brain's not functioning. Okay. Will also help increase methionine and cephalin in the cerebral spinal fluid and also reduces release of the excitatory neurotransmitters glutamate and substance P in the spinal cord dorsal horn in animals with inflammation. What I find most fascinating is the research that's been done on TENS in particular, actually most of our modalities, has all been done on animals. So when we're being told there's no research, there's no evidence that supports, you know, rehab, it's like, oh my gosh, so much of what we know and do and utilize in human rehab was done on animals. That we've utilized the animals as our literal guinea pigs to transfer over to humans. So then it's right there. It is animal research. It is proven. It is validated. And if the humans who can talk say this is how it feels, why can't the human be the guinea pig for the animal? Oh, I'm on another tangent. Okay, so these are the mechanisms for which high-frequency TENS can aid in pain relief. Now you've got your low frequency TENS, okay? So this is less than 10 hertz, and this is more of your tap, 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 tap sensation if you've had this on. Different sensation TENS altogether. And what they found is that low frequency TENS will stimulate a release of endogenous opiates and is often referred to as acupuncture-like TENS because the mechanism for pain relief is similar to acupuncture. So the primary effects the spinal cord segmental level. So it's primarily, I could read, that'd be handy. Okay, so it primarily affects the relevant spinal segmental levels. In that, opioid, GABA, serotonin, and muscarinic receptors are activated by low frequency TENS, and this reduces dorsal horn neuronal activity, and thereby reducing nociception and the consequent pain sensation. Peripheral opioid receptors are also responsible for low frequency TENS in that peripheral, opioid activation, I suppose, is only found in low frequency TENS, but not high frequency. So your low frequency TENS is activating receptors activating a whole other pain-relieving system and mechanism that your high frequency isn't. So low frequency can be hugely useful. That being said, I would say why not use both? I might say this later, but I'm getting excited about look at combining your TENS machine, your pain relief, and do both high frequency and low frequency. The proposed mechanism for pain relief utilizing electroacupuncture at different frequencies is similar, if not the same, to those demonstrated following TENS stimulation at similar frequencies. So I gotta say, I love acupuncture. I think it's hugely useful. I wish acupuncture studies were done based on acupuncture alone and not utilizing the electroacupuncture, because then I think we would validate acupuncture and not just TENS. I think when you clip an electrode to an acupuncture needle, and say that you're validating acupuncture, you're really just validating intramuscular TENS. All these tangents I get on. Okay, so now, how are you going to apply your TENS? So you can apply your TENS and I would say all of the other modalities this way too. So let's hold that in your back pocket for a minute. So you could simply put it local to the site of the lesion. So it's the dog's stifle that's sore, put your TENS machine around the stifle, laser the stifle, ultrasound the stifle, yada, 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 the stifle. Okay. But you can also utilize dermatomes and myotomes. So you could utilize looking at a dermatomal map and saying, okay, this whole area is supplied by whatever, the L4-5 nerve roots, so I can stimulate anywhere in the L4-5 region, and I'm going to send messages back to that segment at the spinal cord, to the dorsal horn at the spinal cord, and that can help shut down the pain signaling and help with descending inhibitory mechanisms. So we could utilize dermatomes. We can utilize myotomes, which muscles are supplied by which nerves, and again, put this over top of certain muscles. And this is the one I love, is even looking at segmental nerve roots. Okay? So put your TENS machine, your laser, your ultrasound, your whatever on the spine. Okay? Up at the spine to affect the nerve roots then that supply that particular joint and myotome and dermatome in that area. I think we can get so much more when we start looking at this bigger picture. So the next pictures I have up for you here is just nerves, and they're supplied by what? So looking at your myotomes, and these are available for you in the articles section for the members, in the articles section in the neurologic subsection in through there, so you should be able to find this chart as well as the dermatomal chart as well, and I believe, and they should be, if it's not, I'll fix it, that they're also printable too, because I think it's huge that people have this resource and have it with them, have it handy and refer back to it. So good. Alrighty, so my advice for how you would use TENS, it might be a useful modality to use as therapy during an osteoarthritic flare-up. And owners may even look at wanting to purchase a TENS machine. And my goodness, they are dirt cheap nowadays. I would never spend more than $200, but you can get some good ones for $100 or less. And so the owners may want to purchase them so that they can use the TENS machine more regularly for day-to-day aches and pains for their pet and quite likely themselves, and they'll all get hooked on it. Okay. So next is pulsed electromagnetic field therapy. Now, with this, there are conflicting results for its use in the treatment of osteoarthritis pain. So there certainly are differing results, but there are so many different ways then that and machines that are being utilized and tested, and whether there are so many of the stuff that's being done in research settings is being done like on poor little rats and they would create their own magnetic field. So they're going to wrap a wire around, like a padded bandage on these rats, and they create their own magnetic field. And you'll see studies where they utilize magnetic field for 6, 8, 12, 20 hours a day. So huge variations within what's out there in the literature. So if we look at what's good out there, so Vasquez et al. 2009 reviewed relevant randomized controlled trials and concluded that pulsed electromagnetic field improved clinical scores and function in patients with osteoarthritis of the knee. So obviously a human study, but we can take this to the animal side. So it has that potential. A handful of studies, now these were all industry funded, have looked at post-operative pain and found pulsed electromagnetic field to be useful. They found that it decreased pain medication use and improved visual analog scale scores. So I always laugh because most of these studies that I could find pertain to either breast augmentation or breast reduction. So whether you want to have big boobs or small boobs, either way you should do your... You can grab up one of these little handy-dandy pulse electromagnetic field units and feel good about it afterwards. So, lastly then with this, my advice is that pulse electromagnetic field has potential. We maybe need a few more studies, but it definitely has potential. And so it might be something that could be utilized for regular maintenance or flare-up treatments, flare-up osteoarthritis. And if it's been shown to, if it's useful to that client, to that patient, then again, owners can purchase inexpensive units for home use as well. I'm all about what they can do to function on their own and what they can do to empower the patient, empower the owner in this case, what they can do. So this might be something that's useful. Okay, and then we got ultrasound. And ultrasound is a highly utilized modality in human physical therapy practice. Clinically, it's been shown to be a benefit for pain relief and improved function in osteoarthritis. And studies there are most extensively done on human knee arthritis. So that works, ties in quite nicely with this topic of pain management for chronic and osteoarthritic animals. And what they found is that it increases the effectiveness of exercise therapies, thus yielding functional improvements. Now think about that. That is huge. That if we look at our rehab strategies, okay, our rehab strategies and how we're going to put together our rehab plan for an animal. So let's say we have the dog comes in and he's got a crappy stifle joint, arthritic stifle joint. Maybe what we look at is we could utilize ultrasound first. We could use ultrasound on the stifle joint first, and then we do our therapeutic exercise program. Because what's been shown in humans is you have better function afterwards. So therefore, you should be able to make better gains, better muscle building. And all of that is going to help with the pain relief, help with the proper mechanical loading of a joint. That's huge. Okay? It can also help with the improvements in joint range of motion. And there, boy, suddenly, let's go to an accent, and thereby help reduce pain, and it's been shown to improve walking endurance. So there's so much. This is cool. I think this becomes really cool. And I'm going to say, although this is what was studied in ultrasound, we can take this and utilize the same thought process utilizing a TENS machine, utilizing your laser, utilizing any other piece of equipment with thought process. If you first target pain reduction as your first treatment and then move on to your exercise, perhaps you get a better overall effect. So, very excited. Okay. Intra-articular studies on the human knee and rat, okay, found that it will help enhance cartilage repair, happy, can help stimulate collagen synthesis in the articular cartilage as well. So it can be useful for the whole reason there's arthritis, so we can help with cartilage repairs. And we saw that with laser. And a study I didn't put up in the pulse electromagnetic field section was that pulse electromagnetic field has been shown to help with collagen and cartilage regeneration, and that is a study done on guinea pigs, literally guinea pigs. So yay. Okay. Now next slide is ultrasound has also been shown to be beneficial for myofascial trigger points. And I'm getting, I get so excited, and so has laser, and so has TENS, but okay. So myofascial trigger points, which may be present with osteoarthritic joints, due to the central sensitization. So think about this. Every time you have an osteoarthritic joint, so this isn't just about ultrasound. I know, I want you to think big picture. I'm talking about ultrasound, but I want you to think big picture. So big picture, if you have an arthritic joint, it's likely to cause movement compensation strategies, and if we have peripheral and there secondarily central sensitization, that's going to create abnormal motor control and motor functioning that can lead to myofascial trigger points, which is then going to further cause problems, problems with mechanical loading of the joint. So whenever you have an arthritic joint, you need to look at the surrounding muscle tissues, okay? And so here would be one rationale. You need to look for myofascial trigger points. Now, how does ultrasound work? So one, if you utilize thermal ultrasound, this is your continuous ultrasound, the heating ultrasound. So this can improve peripheral nerve function. Heat increases or enhances nerve function. It can increase blood flow, and it might act as a counter-irritant, thus activating spinal gating mechanisms. Now, if you use non-thermal or your pulsed ultrasound, this causes acoustic streaming, which is movement of the fluids across cell membranes, and it may cause stable cavitation, where it's the creation of transient gas bubbles in the sound field, which may cause cell membrane disruption, which may enhance cellular permeability, and thereby even better utilization of anti-inflammatory medications. So it's just a thought process out there that this might have a larger impact than is a straightforward what it does. So it may augment or enhance your anti-inflammatory meds. But here's the crapper, is that hair absorbs heat and absorbs the ultrasound, heats the tissues, and can impede the ultrasound going into the actual tissues. So you may need to look at, is this a really hairy dog? And in which case, and shaving isn't an option, which for most owners, even if it's not a show dog or that, they really are not so thrilled with having their dog shaved. So unless it's maybe a short-haired dog or there has been a recent shave of the area, you know, it might not be the best modality to choose. So my advice, ultrasound therapy may be utilized as a maintenance treatment or for osteoarthritic flare-ups in the dog with an appropriate amount of hair or lack of. Ultrasound can be utilized on joints that are accessible in location, but hair cover may need to be addressed. So your short-haired dogs, this would be fine for, your greyhounds and Dobermans and maybe boxers, but beyond that, we're going to have to start thinking about its actual effectiveness. And what we don't know, that the Steifedel study was done using continuous wave or heating ultrasound. What we don't know is how much sound waves are absorbed if with pulsed ultrasound. So we're not getting the heating effect, but we know there's some absorption. So we still have to throw that in. Maybe we just really, really, really increase the dosage of a pulsed ultrasound. But this we don't know. I'm throwing out thoughts. And ultrasound could be utilized on secondary myofascial trigger points. Okay? Good. Then we move on to mobilizations. So you would have, what we know is that MOBs and manipulations affect pain via different mechanisms than originally thought. So essentially, research cannot validate a biomechanical effect, that is, the correction of a position fault, in that my back is out or it feels like your pelvis is in this position, research can't actually validate that. And the studies that look at experts, and they maybe have a panel of experts and they all assess the same patient, they find that inter-rater reliability is absolutely dismal. Okay? That's what we think we're doing. Those of us taken, like myself, taken several manual therapy courses. But it's not what we can validate. So what can be validated with your MOBs and manipulations is that they have a neurophysiological effect. And this is a reduction in pain and inhibition of reflexive muscle contractions. So if we go further, what we know is that to achieve a neurophysiologic effect requires repetitive oscillatory movements, sustained manual stimuli, okay? And you know what you're still going to, and because it's been brought up to me, it's like, so where does the manipulation fit into there? Because it's not repetitive oscillatory and it's not sustained manual stimulation, but it is enough of a movement that it manips also set off this neurophysiologic effect. And what happens with this movement that you create in a joint is it results in a hysteresis effect. And this basically means it involves inhibition of low threshold mechanoreceptors, group 1 and 2, and inhibition of high threshold nociceptors, group 3 and 4, and both of which result in a reduction of intraarticular pressure and peripheral afferent discharge. Okay? So when I explain hysteresis effect, I say it changes pressure in the joint and its reaction, or basically its sounding out mechanisms. It makes it quieter. So, we know that a mechanical force is needed to initiate the chain of neurophysiologic effects. The neurophysiologic responses happen both peripherally, like right at the joint, as well as centrally. And that manual therapy may directly affect inflammatory mediators and peripheral nociceptors, so via reduction in blood and serum level of cytokines. If we go on, we know that there are spinal mechanisms. So manual therapy may act as a counter-irritant to modulate pain and bombard the central nervous system with sensory input from muscle proprioceptors. We know that there are supraspinal mechanisms, and I believe that we know that that's from rat studies. So supraspinal mechanisms have been shown to be activated with manual therapy to modulate pain. And other mechanisms have been shown in that manual therapy can create autonomic responses, opioid responses, even placebo effect, expectation, and psychosocial factors. Okay, psychosocial is a huge area in human pain management that I believe is altogether untapped on the veterinary side. And so to start thought processing that, so that's beyond the scope of what I'm talking about, but you know what, even psychosocial factors as it ties into this topic. So you have your dog with, or your horse with arthritic joints, and they love getting out and competing in their sport or practicing in their sport. All of that is going to help, just even from the mechanisms that it has on the brain and the body in that capacity, the endocrine system and the autonomic nervous system and all the rest. So those are your psychosocial factors that simply getting out, doing things helps with the psychosocial factors. So psychosocial factors in this aspect could just be the patient is having an interaction with the therapist in doing the manual therapy, and that just brings about feelings of happiness and targets these psychosocial factors. Okay. So my advice then in utilizing mobilizations is that it can be a maintenance therapy for osteoarthritic joints. So that if we've got these arthritic dogs and they come in for routine therapy, which might include your modalities. It should also include your mobilizations, not only to the affected joint, but possibly to the adjacent joints. So let's say you have a crappy stifle, maybe do a few mobs on the tarsus and the hip as well. And potentially to the spinal vertebral segments as they relate to dermatomes that overlie the affected joint. So if I have a stifle problem, that should be femoral nerve, L4-5. So you could also do mobilizations on the L5 vertebrae, for example. And it may have an impact for pain relief at the stifle joint. Okay, then we get into massage. And massage can have neurophysiologic effects. It can have neuropsychologic effects. And will also have just straightforward mechanical benefits as well. So when we look at massage and pain relief, okay, so it's been shown that it increases the plasma concentrations of beta endorphins. It will help decrease systolic blood pressure and reduce cortisol levels. So all happy, 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 reducing stress. It can assist in pain reduction and increase pain tolerance, but only for as long as regular massage routine is maintained. So one of these, I can't remember which one it was, but one of those studies had looked at doing regular massage on patients. I think they were doing once a week massage, and they were finding that the patients benefited. They felt pain relief, more increased pain tolerance, more happiness, all the rest. But when they stopped the massage, things went back to baseline levels at about 3 weeks. So what that tells us is, I'm going to blow my last slide, but basically, one, that perhaps the owner should be shown how to do massage on a regular basis, and or if you've got clients who would just rather bring their dog in for massage, you or an assistant or a massage therapist or whoever is trained in massage within your facility could do massage, but you need to have it spaced at least within a 3 week interval. So of course, you know, if you're a big fan of massage, this also gives you justification to get a massage for once, no less than every 3 weeks apart. Now the bonus impact, what has also been shown, is that massage-like stroking has been found to optimize digestion and improve nutrient assimilation. So these are studies done on infants as well as rats. So that can be an added benefit. And that the neuropsychological benefits are that it improves mood, reduces anxiety and depression, and improves sleep. All things that are hugely important for pain relief. So again, my advice is that regular massage may be beneficial to these patients, and it might be something that is an in-clinic or home management strategy that's utilized. And then we've got stretching. So stretching as it relates to OA pain has not actually been studied. Okay? But as we look at what we can take from stretching research is that it may increase the effectiveness of isokinetic exercise in terms of functional improvement in human patients with knee osteoarthritis. So if you were doing regular stretching, it could help with functional improvements with knee osteoarthritis. It can increase in joint range of motion when utilized daily, and this was a study that was Croquetal doing passive stretching on dogs, and she found that it increased joint range of motion, so that might imply that it could help with function of an osteoarthritic stifle. But what we don't know is, do these functional improvements equate to a decrease in pain? And we don't know. We don't know. But certainly there would be justification for helping with function. So my advice here is that owners could incorporate stretching as part of their home management routine along with some massage. And then, I think this is lastly, and then we have exercise. And systematic reviews show pain improvement with exercise in human patients with neck pain, chronic low back pain, pelvic pain, osteoarthritis, patellofemoral pain, intermittent claudication, fibromyalgia, rheumatoid arthritis, and tendinopathy. So all tons of studies, I guess, many studies out there that show exercise helps for pain relief in all of these sorts of cases. So my advice for exercise is to allow the animal to maintain participation in sports at some level, if at all possible. Let them do something. And sometimes this is just a matter of talking with the owners to say, well, are there any modifications you can make? Is there a way, let's say agility, is there a way of doing agility that doesn't incorporate as much jumping? Can they do a course that doesn't include the jumping? Well, yeah, they can do tunnels and weaves. Oh, okay, well, that's fabulous. So talk to the owners, because give them the opportunity or guide them in ways that they can come up with something so that will benefit their dog and still get them and their dog out enjoying their sport. Prescribe exercises specific to the affected joint in order to further improve function. So it's all well and great. Yeah, we're doing underwater treadmill. Yeah, we've told the patient they should be walking. Goody, goody, goody. Come up with something. So if this is hip arthritis, come up with a targeted exercise to stimulate the glutes. If this is a stifle, come up with targeted exercise for the quads and the hams. Okay, come up with exercises that will impact the muscles most function, that most affected, okay? Because this should then subsequently help to reduce pain. So in conclusion, mild and moderate osteoarthritis is often common in sporting animals, and physical therapies can be part of a multimodal treatment regimen for the canine athlete, and which can then help enable animals to enjoy participation in sports as they age. Okay? And basically, pain management is no longer just about medication. There's so much more that can be done. There you go. You made it through. Thank you for listening.